Aren't you the one who said that help had arrived?
The red-maned Rin named Safa asked Worth Skidder aboard the slave ship Kresh. I might have said something to that effect, the Jedi was willing to concede. Heat of the moment and all that. Roa regarded Skidder with interest, then glanced past him at Safa.
When was this?
On Jindyne, she told him, when he rushed to be captured. He said, take heart, help has arrived.
Roa looked at Skidder once more. He rushed. You make it sound like he wanted to be captured.
Safa shrugged. It looked that way from where I stood.
To wind up here? Skidder said. A guy would have to be either deranged or dauntless.
Smile lines formed at the corners of Roa's eyes.
I've known a few in my day who were both. I can't put my finger on it, but something tells me you fit the bill.
Side by side, the three of them were standing to their waists in the viscous nutrient in which the young Yamosk marinated, like an excised brain in an autopsy pan. One of the more gracile of the creature's manifold tentacles floated in front of Skidder and his comrades, and their hands were busy massaging and caressing it. Roa's pal Fasgo and two Rin were doing the same to the other side of the tentacle. The arrangement of six to a tentacle was repeated throughout the circular Yorick coral basin. At the moment, Qin Kao was completing a circle on the grated walkway that ran around the lip of the basin.
For all the revulsion it seems to invoke in some of you, the Yamosk is an extremely sensitive creature, he was saying. One effect of its powerful desire to bond is empathy of a high order, which later culminates as telepathy of a sort. As part of its early training, the Yamosk is conditioned to regard select Dovin Basils as its children, its brood. The same Dovin Basils that provide thrust for our starships and the single-pilot craft the New Republic military refers to as coral skippers. When, then, we enter into engagements with the forces of your worlds, the Yamosk sees its children as threatened and attempts to coordinate their activities to minimize loss.
Qin Kao began another circuit on the organic walkway.
As some of you have already learned, battle coordination is only one of the Yamosk's talents. When I told you earlier that its empathy bordered on telepathy, I was not overstating things. Also, as part of its training, the young Yamosk is conditioned to establish a cognitive rapport with the commander in whose custody the Yamosk will serve. In fact, this Yamosk and myself are already on familiar terms. But we're going to attempt something that has never been done. The truly extraordinary part of this joint endeavor. We wish the Yamosk to become familiar with you, with all of you, so that we might bring this invasion to a speedy and relatively painless conclusion. As the Yamosk becomes more accustomed to your touch, Qin Kao was saying, it may wish to touch you back. You will allow it to do so. I caution you not to resist its telepathic pulls, for you risk injuring yourself as much as the Yamosk. Resistance could very well result in madness or death.
He's not kidding,
Roa said with sudden solemnity. He looked intently at Safa, then Skidder.
Try to keep your mind blank. Otherwise, it will pursue your thoughts like a predator chasing the first meal of the day. Believe me, I've seen it happen more than once.
Skidder had been doing his best to hide his Jedi-ness and the events that had motivated him to be captured. Faced with Qin Kao's revelation, however, he suddenly could not suppress his urgency to make contact with his fellow Jedi and appraise them of the enemy's latest plan. He turned slightly to gaze at the Yamosk's eyes, and those ink-black organs seemed to gaze back at him. The tentacle beneath his hands rippled, and its blunt tip rose from the nutrient to wrap around Skidder's shoulders. Roa, Safa, and the others fell back in surprise.
Why, Cain, Roa said. I do believe the Yamosk has taken a liking to you.
From the rear of Laurel Hall on Hapes, Leia was a bright white speck against the blue-black of the night sky, visible through the towering panoramic windows at her back. Esteemed representatives of the Hapes Consortium of Worlds, she began. 18 years ago, following the New Republic's conquest of Imperial Center, I came before you to solicit financial support for a fledgling government bankrupted by war. It was thought then that the New Republic and the Consortium might enter into an alliance through matrimony, though Destiny had other unions in store for the would-be partners in that marriage. Gracious laughter and hushed exchanges swept through the audience. Leia took the opportunity to glance to the right, where Prince Isolde sat, smiling. Beside him, also smiling and elegantly attired, sat his wife, Queen Mother Tenennial Jo of Dathomir. Alongside Tenennial sat her mother-in-law, Ta'achum. "My friends," Leia continued, "the New Republic and the Consortium have never been anything but allies. But I come before you tonight with a request that is sure to test the bonds of the Alliance. And in place of gifts, I bring only an urgent warning. A great shadow has been cast on the galaxy. So grim is this shadow, so monstrous and far-reaching, it may well have the power to extinguish all light." Leia paused and remained silent until agitated murmuring quieted. "They are called the Yuuzhang Vong. And as I speak, they are poised to invade the colonies and the core. The New Republic Defense Force has tried and failed to save scores of worlds. Their huts have apparently struck a deal with the Yuuzhang Vong that allows the invaders to occupy and utilize hut worlds for resources essential to the invasion. Now I ask the Consortium to decide which course it will pursue."
"Delegate Melarta," Queen Mother Ta'achum said, "Ambassador Oganes Solo, Ambassador Solo, Lol Melarta of Terraform."
Leia extended her right hand with practiced graciousness and glanced down the reception line, which wound nearly to the grand entrance of the Fountain Palace, home to the Hapi's royal family.
"Tiring of the formalities, Ambassador?"
Ta'achum asked from behind her veil. Leia turned slightly to regard her.
"Not at all. You mean to say that you don't find the process somewhat, how shall I put it, antiquated?"
Leia smiled to herself. "I sometimes miss the pomp and circumstance of the old Republic. Hapes feels like a fond memory frozen in time."
"Why, how sweet of you to reduce our way of life to mere nostalgia."
"You mistake my meaning, Ta'achum. With purpose, I think." Leia swept her eyes over the reception room. "This might have been my life, if not for the Empire." Ta'achum's eyes narrowed.
"Ah, but it could easily have been yours, my dear. It was you who chose Han Solo over my son."
Leia looked at Chumla Isolde, who stood tall, impeccably dressed, and incurably handsome at the head of the reception line. "Yes," she told herself, "I chose a two-fisted rogue without a credit to his name, over a scion of pirates with pockets deep enough to finance his own war. And thank the stars for that."
"Hakon Thane," Ta'achum was saying, "Ambassador Organas Solo. Ambassador Solo, Hakon Beed Thane of Virgil."
Robust and fully bearded, Thane was one of the Consortium's few male delegates. He glowered as he stepped in front of her.
"Ambassador Solo," he said, slurring his words. "The infamous Jedi."
Ta'achum stiffened.
"I would caution you to keep a civil tongue, Hakon. Or have you perhaps sipped too freely of the drink we provided?"
Thane nodded in a bow.
"Your pardon, Araneda," he said,
using the title reserved for Hapen Queen Mothers.
"Your generosity has certainly undone me."
Leia reached out with her feelings. Thane wasn't drunk. He was merely acting drunk.
"I'm not a Jedi, Archon," she told him.
"As to my infamy, it is certainly your prerogative to think what you will." He swung to her.
"Spoken like a Jedi, calmly in full possession. The statement weaker minds might be inclined to embrace as the full truth."
"Careful, Archon,"
Ta'achum seethed under her breath.
"I'm certain you don't wish to cause a scene."
A crowd had begun to form around Thane, and conversations throughout the vast room began to subside. Out of the corner of her eye, Leia saw Prince Isolde making a direct line for the center of the commotion.
"We have only the ambassador's word that the Yuuzhang Vong can't be dealt with,"
Thane was telling everyone within earshot.
"And if what she says about forming a united front is true, Why is the New Republic divided about where to deploy its fleets and to which systems it should render aid? As Archon of Vigil, I say we remain neutral until such time as the invaders make certain their plans for the consortium, either by word or force of arms.
He gestured toward Leia.
She comes to us asking a favor and bringing only the gift of a warning.
That'll be enough, Thane, Isolde said angrily. This isn't a time or place for a political debate. If you can't abide by the rules of decorum...
You'll toss me out of your palace, Thane cut him off. You'd sooner host the descendants of those Jedi who killed your ancestors than someone who dares speak the truth in your presence.
Demonstrating uncanny speed, Isolde backhanded Thane across the face, knocking him into the crowd and drawing blood from his lower lip. Two of Thane's supporters rushed to take him by the arms and stand him on his feet, but he threw them aside, wiped his hand across his mouth, and snorted a laugh at Isolde.
The spurned suitor to the rescue.
Leia's heart sank. She couldn't help but dread Thane's next move.
My seconds will call on you in the morning, Chunda Isolde, the Archon of Vigil said with complete sobriety.
Isolde returned a formal nod of assent.
My seconds will be waiting to greet them. Thus begins the schism,
Ta'achum said in a sad, quiet voice, as Thane and his supporters headed for the door.
Punch it, Droma!
Han yelled as he veered the Falcon into an abrupt bank. Muttering nervously to himself, Droma boosted power to the sublight drives and maxed the throttle.
We'll be fine venturing into hot space, you said. You used to do a lot of contract work up and down the Sizar run, and this real yours is like a second home, you said. Nothing to worry about.
Quit griping and give me an update on those ships.
Droma swung to the display screen of the ship's friend or foe authenticator, which showed seven bezel-shaped icons closing fast on the Falcon's aft.
You Zhang Fang, all right.
Han glanced at the display.
Let's see if we can't even up the odds.
He peeled the ship away in a sweeping descending bank. They ripped through a filmy blanket of high-altitude clouds and went spiraling downward. Storm systems shrouded Sri Lura's western horizon, and to the north an expansive brown haze smudged the terrain. Droma glanced at the meteorological sensors.
That's a sandstorm.
The words had barely left his mouth when the lead coral skipper dropped with mind-boggling velocity and was suddenly beneath the Falcon and firing up at her, plasma geysering from its gun emplacements. Han pulled out of the spiral, yanked the throttle, and threw the ship up and over the coral skipper, directly on his tail. A molten bolt from the craft below caught its squadron mate full on. The coral skipper shuddered as hunks of Yorick coral flew in all directions. Then an interior explosion burst from the crystalline cockpit, and the crippled ship went into a helpless free fall, condemned to death by gravity. Without warning, a plasma bolt sizzled through the rear shields. A muffled explosion sounded from aft, followed by the sibilant hiss of the ship's fire suppression system. An acrid smell drifted forward on exhaust fan currents. Han sniffed and shot Droma a wide-eyed glance.
What was that?
Droma's eyes roamed over the console telltales.
Power converter.
Han winced.
Of all the rotten luck.
Han utilized more of the ship's amazing speed to improve their lead and leapt deeper into the swirling haze. The three coral skippers decreased velocity, waiting for the Falcon to come across their vector. But instead, Han poured on all power, climbed, looped, and came around behind the trio. Droma fired instinctively with the belly gun. With the Dovin Basil of the trailing ship too stressed to handle defense as well as guidance, the laser bolt sneaked through. The widespread burst caught the craft right on the nose, blowing it to nuggets. Han hooted triumphantly as he sheered off and settled calmly into kill position behind the second craft. The coral skipper pilot, realizing the position he was suddenly in, climbed slightly, unintentionally placing himself in the overlapping field of fire between the Falcon's upper and lower batteries.
Money lane,
Han shouted.
100 credits to whoever nails him.
You're on, Droma said.
Simultaneously, the two of them tightened their fingers on the trigger. The quad lasers loosed storms of red darts that peppered the rear of the enemy craft and perforated the cockpit, disintegrating the ship. Han and Droma howled their joy. The Falcon's thrusters flaring, Han pulled up sharply, climbing out of the storm at high boost. None of the surviving fighters followed them back up the well. They collapsed into their chairs as the stars lost their twinkle and swarmed around them as pinpoints of light.
Nice shooting,
Han said after checking in with the threat assessor one final time. Droma returned the grin. Nice driving. The Falcon bucked. Indicators flashed and the console came alive with warning tones. The hyperdrive is viable but responding erratically, Droma said a moment later. Han nodded glumly. Must have suffered collateral damage when the power converter got hit. Droma tugged at one end of his drooping mustache. We might be able to make Narshada. It's difficult to tell.
No, Han said. We can't chance it. I doubt we'll find the replacement parts we need there. Besides, I don't want to risk running into those coral skippers again.
So, where to?
Han studied the displayed star charts and grinned. A little out-of-the-way place, I know, where they'll have everything we need.
Everything Han Solo needs,
Droma thought to point out.
Maybe you're right, Han said.
He turned slightly to regard Droma.
Think you can handle playing captain for a while?
On Coruscant, in the new office that had come with her appointment to the advisory council, Senator Vicky Shesh lowered herself into an antique armchair from her native Kuat and glanced around the office, smiling slowly as she took in the spacious room. Well appointed without being ostentatious, the room enjoyed a breathtaking view of Commerce Way and the New Republic obelisk. Not bad for someone who had entered the political arena only 6 short years ago, Shesh told herself. The office comm sounded.
Senator Shesh, Commodore Brand has arrived.
Admit him,
Shesh answered. She rose from the chair, smoothed the black skirt that sheathed her long legs. By the time Brand entered, she was settled behind the desk.
Commodore Brand, how delightful to see you.
Brand shook her hand as decorously as he could and tried to make himself comfortable in the tight confines of the armchair.
Congratulations on being named to the council, Senator.
Why, thank you, Commodore. To what do I owe the honor of your visit?
Brand cleared his throat meaningfully.
The Corellian situation, Senator.
Shesh nodded.
The re-enabling of Centerpoint Station. In my opinion, a judicious decision.
Then you're not concerned about possible repercussions?
An armed and dangerous Corellia, for example? Of course not. A well-defended Corellia benefits the entire Corps.
Brand regarded her for a long moment. Yes, but what if I were to tell you that even more might be gained by inducing the Yuzhong Vong to attack Corellia? Shesh raised an eyebrow.
Are you, in fact, telling me that, Commodore? Because if you are, I would be obliged to bring this matter to the attention of the Advisory Council immediately.
The Defense Force intends to do just that, Senator, Brand said in a rush.
Unfortunately, however, we find ourselves in something of a dilemma.
A dilemma?
Shesh repeated.
Assuming first that we could succeed in luring the Yuzhong Vong to Corellia, we must ensure that we can defeat them soundly. And while we wouldn't want to tip our hand by massing ships at Corellia, we would need to pull from Batui and a host of similarly defended worlds to amass the required armada.
Shesh took a moment to respond.
You're concerned that the Advisory Council would refuse to sanction any actions that would imperil Bothery and the others. And yet, to accomplish your goal, it would have to appear as if Bothery is being defended to the disadvantage of Corellia.
Brand almost grinned. She appraised him openly.
I see that I've read you correctly. Though I still wonder why you think it necessary to bring this to my attention.
Brand held her gaze.
Should the matter go to a vote, the Defense Force would want to make certain that Bothery wins out.
Shesh fell silent for a long moment.
You said that this entire plan rests on the assumption that you can entice the Yuzhong Vong to attack Corellia. As I understand it, you hope to accomplish this by leaving Corellia essentially undefended, in the hope that the enemy takes note of that fact. But wouldn't it be more profitable if word got out about what you're doing?
For its technological powers alone, Center Point Station would be an irresistible target for destruction. Brand tugged at his earlobe. This isn't something we can simply announce over the holonet, Senator.
Chesh laughed shortly.
There are better lines to the Yuuzhan Vong than the holonet. She gave it a moment, then added, the huts. If they had even an inkling of your plan, they would certainly apprise the Yuuzhan Vong, if only in the interest of safeguarding their future.
But the New Republic has broken off diplomatic relations with the huts. To communicate with them at this point...
The Hutt Consul General is still on Coruscant. I could pay him a visit and let slip a few things.
Brand stared at her. You would do that?
I would. But in return, in the event the true purpose of my visit ever came to light, I would want it known that the Defense Force asked me to intercede.
Brand smiled. You should have gone into the military, Senator. You would have made a brilliant tactician.
The military?
Shesh snorted in derision.
I don't mean any disrespect, Commodore, but why would I want to be the one who fires the weapon when I can be the one who decides at whom the weapon is pointed?
The size of a Victory-class Star Destroyer, the bulk freighter Starmaster hung above the inert Twi'lek homeworld, Ryloth. Closing steadily on a rectangular docking bay moved a lunette-shaped craft. In a lower deck compartment forward in the freighter, two Rodians monitored the approaching crescent on a display screen.
Is that his ship?
The Twi'lek pacing behind them asked when the craft landed.
His ship? One of the Rodians scoffed. There's dozens of ships. Let's wait and see who disembarks.
Three human males and a female appeared on the craft's boarding ramp. Moving with lithe economy, the first two men might have been brothers, though the taller one's face was hideously scarred, where the other's was slim and angular. Dark-haired and willowy, the woman also moved with care, and there was a coiled wariness to her step and a vigilant gleam in her eyes. The last man out had an air of confident nonchalance. In contrast to the shin-high spacer's boots and long cloaks affected by his confederates, he was dressed in silk and leather.
That's him, the other Rodian said, indicating the latter male. That's Card. No information on the other men, but neither is armed with blasters. The scanner matches the woman to Shada Dukal, a known associate of Card's.
The second Rodian lifted a blaster from his hip holster, checked the charge, and primed the weapon.
Unnecessary,
the Twi'lek told him.
They'd be fools to try anything. Anyway, the boss has agreed to this meeting.
I still don't understand why Card would be interested in dealing with us,
the armed Rodian remarked.
He traffics in information, not spice.
The Twi'lek caressed his bulged forehead and moved to the hatchway.
This isn't about spice.
He aimed a remote at the hatchway sensor, and the hatch pocketed itself into the bulkhead. Card and the others entered, his two male companions hanging back, and Shada Dukal sidestepping into a corner, where she could keep a watchful eye on the proceedings.
Welcome, Talon Card,
the Twi'lek said in basic.
I'm Rol Warren.
Card nodded. A pleasure. He didn't bother to introduce anyone else. Just then a hatch opened to reveal a stout man filling the portal.
Krev Bombesa, Card said. You're a long way from home.
As are you, Talon.
Bombesa looked at Shada.
And the always enchanting Shada Dukal. As for my being far from home, even life in the Pembroke system can grow boring.
With an explicit nod, Bombesa dismissed Rol Warren and the Rodians, then lowered himself into a chair at the console. He glanced at Kip Duran and Ganner Rizode, then smiled at Card.
So, why have you come, Talon? And don't tell me you're serious about going into the spice trade.
Card looked him in the eye.
I appreciate your frankness, Krev. The fact is the Yuuzhan Vong have changed the way everyone is doing business.
Bombesa nodded at Card.
You're right, Talon. Just where that leaves people like you and me has yet to be determined.
Speak for yourself, Krev. I know where I stand. Bombesa took a breath.
I'm a practical man, Talon. I wish only to survive. And under the best possible circumstances, I can arrange for myself. You say your stance is decided. Then suppose you tell me what's on your mind.
Card's eyes narrowed. You haven't been shipping to Tinna, Barthui, or Corellia.
That much is true,
Bombesa said. The Yuzhang Vong are in hot space, Card continued. They've already hit Jindan. So one might reasonably assume that you're merely trying to avoid areas of potential conflict.
I commend you on your acuity. Why risk shipments by sending them into contested space?
Then either you're merely being careful, or you're heeding orders that come down from the huts. Bombesa glanced at the ceiling.
Let's just say that the huts at this juncture are in a better position to ascertain which areas are dangerous.
Card nodded. I thought so. And how will you justify this conversation to Borga? Bombesa's shoulders heaved in a shrug.
Borga has been expecting just such an encounter in any case.
Playing both sides, is she?
Looking out for number one.
Card could not restrain a smile.
I won't forget this, Krev.
Bombesa steepled his thick fingers and brought them to his double chin.
Then you might mention me to your friends as affirmation of just whose side I'm on.
In the grotto-like docking bay of the Yamask vessel Kresh, Commander Qin Kao welcomed Randa Besati Diori and his retinue aboard. Propelled by his muscular tail, the young Hutt emerged from his shuttle, smiling broadly, and instantly at home in the cavernous, dimly lighted space.
I am eager to learn as much as I can of your operations, so that we Hutts may expedite your needs. But perhaps you could first show me to my quarters, so that I might refresh from the journey.
We have prepared a place for you, Randa Besati Diori,
Qin Kao answered.
On the way, I thought I would introduce you to the ship's most prestigious passenger.
Qin Kao brought the procession to a halt in the rank belly of the ship and directed Rhonda's attention to an aperture in the membranous bulkhead that provided a vantage into an adjacent hold. Below, centered in a circular tank of syrupy liquid, floated a tentacled life form that could only have been created by the Yuzhang Vong. Sharing the tank with the creature and plainly attending to it stood several dozen captives. Rhonda turned excitedly to Qin Kao.
You have succeeded in capturing a somewhat rare specimen, Commander. Those sharp-nosed bipeds over there, they are Rin, an entertaining species, highly prized by the Hutts for their skill at dancing and singing. But their real talent is prognostication. Sadly, I have had no direct experience with them,
Rhonda smiled.
Perhaps you would be willing to relieve them temporarily of their peculiar duties and judge for yourself.
The commander nodded and turned to a subaltern of the guards.
Have the six Rin brought to the hut's compartment.
To three sides, the sea stretched to the horizon. An expanse of surging teal frosted with whitecaps and dazzled by daybreak sunlight. And at Leia's back climbed the rocky spires and imposing parapets of Reef Fortress, the Hapen royal family's summer home and stronghold in times of crisis. Against a cool offshore breeze, she hugged herself within the dark blue wrap of her long cloak and turned through another circle, taking in the score of visitors who had arrived at dawn by dragon yacht to witness the duel between Isolde and Beed Thane.
Mistress Leia, C-3PO said in a fret, I had hoped you would decide to spare yourself the torment of having to watch Prince Isolde engage in such an antiquated and obviously vain exercise in what can only be considered pecking order politics.
Leia frowned at him. As the insulted party, I could hardly absent myself, 3PO.
But, Mistress, C-3PO pressed, do you have any idea of what Prince Isolde and Archon Thane are about to do?
Leia glanced at the lawn, where Thane and Isolde were already donning the sensor and electrode-studded headgear, power gloves, boots, and body armor that were integral to the contest.
I have some idea,
Leia said.
But, Mistress,
C-3PO said hopelessly. She silenced him in order to hear what Isolde was telling Thane as they faced off in the center of the lawn.
Should you win, you will not only have redeemed your honor, but earned the right to brag of having defeated the Prince of Hapes. Should I win, I want your pledge that Vajil will agree to a united Hapen support of the New Republic,
The witnesses gasped.
This cannot be permitted,
someone shouted. Neither of you has the right, another voice added. Thane considered it while the arguments continued.
You have my pledge, the Archon said at last, provided that Hapes will withhold support if you lose.
You bring disgrace on all our houses, a witness remarked.
Isolde nodded. You have my pledge. Leia's heart raced. Beside her, Ta'ad Shum said,
This has been Thane's goal all along. As Hapes goes, so goes half the consortium of worlds.
She looked at Leia.
You see what my son undertakes for you.
On the lawn, the principal referee raised a red scarf high overhead and let it flutter to the ground. It had scarcely touched the tallest blade of grass when the fight commenced.
What an appalling display, C-3PO remarked worriedly.
Isolde and Thane worked each other around for several long minutes without scoring, though the punishing blows they rained on each other sounded like the muffled reports of ancient firearms. Exposed flesh reddened and swelled. A punch from Isolde drove Thane clear across the lawn. A front kick by the Archon lifted the prince completely off his feet. Then both of them scored in rapid succession, when Isolde left himself open to a blow to the head in order to land a powerful, twisting punch to Thane's ribs. The rooting of the onlookers was enthusiastic, urging each man on. Time and again, Isolde caught Thane's foot in his upper arm or shoulder, or managed to duck his head out of the way. But Isolde appeared to be tiring. With little left to pitch that he hadn't already tried, he again advanced with left fist, right fist, as wind up for a right roundhouse kick. Thane set himself for a feint and counter. Isolde let him believe he had chosen correctly by using broken timing, appearing for an instant to be faking, then let fly the intended roundhouse. From the sound of the impact, it was clear that Isolde had planned the kick to connect with enough force to end the match. The slap of the boot on the head guard echoed off the black rocks that graced the shore, and the primary referee had one hand up to signal the winning point before Thane had hit the ground. Many of the witnesses were beside themselves with outrage, and arguments began to erupt on all sides of the lawn. Archon Thane appeared grudgingly congratulatory, but Leia could see that there would be no lasting peace between House Thane and House Isolde. Leia should have been pleased. Thane's loss meant that the New Republic would have full Hapen support. But instead, something terrible began to blossom in Leia's mind. Her heart pounded and her forehead beaded with sweat. She shut her eyes briefly. And into the darkness raced a ferocious vision of warships speared by brilliant light, of expanding explosions and the cries of dying thousands. Coming back to herself, she saw Thane storming away from the lawn. But before he reached the path that led to the dock, he changed direction and angled for Leia. She braced herself.
Ambassador, rest assured that I will honor my pledge to stand with Prince Isolde.
He scowled despite himself.
For now, I wish only to applaud you for moving the consortium toward what will no doubt prove to be a catastrophic campaign.
Melisma, Gaff, and a dozen other Rin slogged through the refugee camp in shin-deep mud that had formed in the wake of Ruan's most recent downpour. No one was smiling, not even Gaff, who was usually unflappingly sanguine in the worst of conditions. They arrived back at Facility 17 in the Rin encampment to find two human males waiting for them, no doubt to drive home the hopeless nature of their predicament and to sell them on the wisdom of signing on with Salich AG. And yet there was something about the pair that gave Melisma pause. For starters, they were too seedy, even for representatives of Salich AG. The taller one was gangly and bearded, and his long fingers were tobacco-stained. The other, shorter man, was equally unkempt, with grease under his fingernails and grime on his forehead.
Lush as it is, Ruan's a rock like any other when you'd rather be elsewhere, the tall one said to Gaff as he approached.
But every rock has its secret exits,
the shorter man chimed in.
Even Ruan.
Gaff smiled pleasantly.
Yes, and everyone requires a toll we can't afford to pay.
Tall seemed to take the reply as a good sign.
Then maybe you'd like to earn the toll. We represent a concern that provides private transportation to other worlds, Tall explained.
For thousands of credits per passenger, Gaff said.
But, believe it or not, there are folks here with more than that to spend.
The problem is, the short man took over, they lack official permits to travel.
Here's the thing,
the first man said.
The business concern we represent has official authority to transport a shipload of paying clients to Abrigado Ray, which is accepting exiles. But unless we can show our clients' names on official permits of transit, all the credits in the universe won't get any of them off Juan. Gaff and Ravana traded knowing looks.
Go on, Gaff said.
The humans also traded looks. It's no secret that you people are good at forging permits and such, Tall said. Short opened a case and handed Gaff a square of Durasheet bearing an elaborate official seal. This comes straight from Coruscant. Each letter of transit can list up to 100 names, so we'd need 5 of them. Gaff and Ravana conferred for a moment.
We'd need their proper tools, along with the inks and such, Gaff said at last.
Tall shrugged. Whatever you need.
What's in this for us?
Melisma asked. That's entirely up to you. Clothing, food, furniture, you name it.
She gazed at him.
How about transport off Ruan?
Again, the two men traded glances. How many are you? Tall asked.
37, including an infant.
Tall deliberated, nodding his head slowly. We just might be able to arrange that.
I am Plan,
the Latin's Weequay security chief said as he joined Droma and Han in the Falcon's forward hold.
Plan had the thumbs of his big hands hooked into his broad gun belt. His deep-set eyes gave him a haunted, fearsome aspect. Behind him, half a dozen humans and aliens were inspecting various parts of the ship. The mere thought of them pawing through his property filled Han with rage. It took all the control he could summon to keep from going ballistic.
My first mate, Meek,
Droma said, gesturing offhandedly toward Han.
Plan nodded.
Sorry about having to search ship, Captain Droma.
With the hyperdrive behaving erratically, it had been a long, slow trip to Tholaten, an uninhabited world save for a deep, almost undetectable rift legions of smugglers had used over the years. The Falcon, going under the name Sunlight Franchise, had been directed to a landing zone on the floor of a forested cleft called Esau's Ridge. A baritone voice rang out from the starboard ring corridor.
Plan, get a look at this.
Han and Droma followed the security chief into the corridor. Just where the outrigger cockpit branched off, 2 human members of the search team had discovered the removable panels that covered the secret compartments Han had used for smuggling in what felt to him like another lifetime. Plan was grinning bemusedly.
Smugglers?
Now and again, Droma said.
Freelance or for huts?
We're independent contractors.
Plan snorted.
Better ways of earning credits these days.
As he was saying it, a short man wearing mechanics utilities entered the corridor from the extended landing ramp.
Looks like your ship has seen some recent action, he told Droma.
We encountered a Yuzhang Vong patrol. Fortunately, we escaped with nothing more than a damaged power converter and hyperdrive.
The mechanic pursed his lips, glanced around, and nodded.
Vintage ship, but I think we can fix you up with the parts you need.
Plan seemed to relax somewhat.
Would not have to worry about Yuzhong Vong patrols if you knew the right people.
He walked to the entrance to the port ring corridor.
How many passengers this crate carry?
Why do you ask? Droma said.
Plan walked back into the hold.
Many here at Esau's Ridge do contract work for employer who has a direct line to Yuzhong Vong. Relocation runs.
Relocation runs, Han said.
Private transport for refugees eager to escape New Republic camps.
Han's eyes narrowed with suspicion. Depending on what you charge for services, you're either a philanthropist or a predator. Plan laughed.
Because we receive large bonuses on back end, passengers pay only modest amounts. To earn bonuses, contractor requires that we deliver refugees to specific worlds. Worlds that end up Yuzhong Vong targets.
Han had to force his mouth to work. You're recycling them. Refugees pay to leave one camp, find themselves caught up in an invasion, and end up in another camp. He fought down an urge to tear Plan limb from limb. And of course, the Yuzhong Vong are happy because you're making things all the more complicated for the New Republic relief workers. Plan shrugged.
Added burden for New Republic, but steady employment for us. Interested?
We might be, Droma said. Do you have anything going at the moment?
Plan made a regretful sound.
Too bad you not arrived sooner. Some of our people moving a bunch off Rouen very soon.
Joma sat unsteadily at the engineering station, determined not to look at Han. Rouen?
Han glanced briefly at Joma and began to pace.
Maybe we're not too late to join in.
He turned to Plan. How soon can we get the parts we need?
In the dank and underlighted hold that served as both mess hall and dormitory for the privileged captives aboard the Yamask carrier, Worth Skidder carried the bowl of nutrient to his usual spot of deck space, where he lowered himself into a cross-legged posture and forced himself to eat. Shortly, Roa and Fasgo joined him on the floor, as had become their habit. He was down to his last spoonful of nutrient when Roa said,
"Well, look who's returned."
Following Roa's delighted gaze, Skidder turned and saw Safa and her five fellow Rin entering the hold. Instantly, he got to his feet and waved them over. None of the six had been seen since Commander Qin Kao had ordered them away days earlier. Everyone had wondered about their mysterious disappearance, and Skidder was eager to learn where they'd been taken.
"To that?"
Safa said in reply to his question as she lowered herself to the floor. Roa's mouth fell open.
"The hut? On board this ship?"
Safa nodded.
"Randa Besadi Diori, the son of a hut named Borga."
"Why is Randa here?" Skidder asked.
Safa regarded him for a moment.
"It seemed to us that the Yuzhang Vong are grooming him to take charge of transporting prisoners of war, for sacrifices perhaps, or some other purposes."
"So that's the deal they cut for themselves," Skidder said through locked teeth.
"But why were you brought to Randa?"
She laughed without mirth.
"To tell his fortune. Using Rin as diviners was once a pastime of the huts. Amusing to them, frequently fatal to us when the forecasts failed to come true."
Skidder considered it. "So Randa asked you to predict his future," he said at last. "What did you tell him?"
Safa shrugged. "Innocuous things, open to interpretation."
Skidder's eyes narrowed with intent. "Did he ask to see you again?"
Safa nodded. "After his beauty sleep."
"Was Qin Kao present?"
"Yes, he took some interest in our reading of Randa's body markings and palm lines. But he grew bored. I doubt he'll be there next time."
Skidder looked hard at Safa and the other Rin.
"Listen carefully. The next time you're summoned,
you're going to tell Randa that he's going to be betrayed. He's been lured aboard only so that Commander Qin Kao can sacrifice him."
He cut his eyes to Safa. "You understand?"
She and the other Rin regarded one another in bafflement.
"And when that doesn't come to pass, you'll have us all sucking vacuum."
Skidder shook his head. "It will come to pass. Because I'm going to plant an idea in the Yamask that Randa is going to betray Qin Kao, and that he only agreed to come aboard to free us. The Yamask is sure to alert Qin Kao."
Roa frowned at Skidder.
"Look, Kane, just because the creature has taken a liking to you, that doesn't mean you can actually talk to it, much less plant an idea in its brain."
Skidder sneered.
"You're wrong. I've already been conversing with it by using the Force. I'm a Jedi Knight," he announced. "My real name is Worth Skidder."
"Well, well," Roa huffed. "That certainly answers a lot of my questions about you."
"Then I was right," Safa said. "You deliberately allowed yourself to be captured."
Skidder nodded. "At the time, I didn't know they had a war coordinator aboard this ship. But one thing is clear. They're conveying it to a world they plan to invade and utilize as a forward base of operations. We need to learn that destination and find some way to get the information to the Jedi or the New Republic military."
Roa was the first to respond.
"Let's say you do manage to turn Qin Kao and the Hutt against one another. How's that going to help you get what you want?"
Skidder was one step ahead of him. "Once I've gained the Yamask's trust, it's going to tell me where we're headed."
"Okay," Roa said tentatively.
"I'll make use of the Yamask to control the Dovin Basil that drives the ship."
Roa and Safa traded glances.
"And then?" the old man asked.
Skidder fixed him with a look.
"We mutiny."